welcome to the Creative South Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Frostholm. Today I'm talking with Ed Roberts. Ed is a designer and creative strategist. He's written about in-house design for How Magazine and the How Design blog, as well as the Creative Group. He's spoken at AIGA LeadCon and served on the boards for InSource and IHAF. We chat about how, as a member of an in-house team, you can align the way you work with the values of your company without being an order taker. The importance of the in-house design team to be a strategic partner to a company's leadership, to help with innovation, and the ways you can help build that partnership, and more. I want to take a moment, since this will be the last episode of the Creative South Podcast, before switching over to feasting on design in the new year, to thank everyone who has supported the show. Thank you to all of my guests for taking the time to sit down with me and talk about yourselves and your work. You've opened yourself up to a stranger and been vulnerable and generous. I'm thankful for every conversation I've had and getting to know all of my guests a little bit better, and in many cases, becoming friends with the people on the other side of the microphone. Thank you for making my job so much easier by doing the heavy lifting. Thank you to Mike Jones for letting me ride on the Creative South coattails for the past 3 years and knowing when it was time to push me out of the nest. Thank you to everyone who subscribed, listened, and donated to the podcast. If you hadn't tuned in and kept coming back for more, I wouldn't be here today. I hope you'll stick with me when I make the switch to feasting on design. Thank you to all of my sponsors, especially Nadia at Jack Prince, for the continued support and seeing value in sponsoring podcasts. And finally, thank you to my wife Tina and my sons Andy and Will. You've made sacrifices on nights and weekends for the past 3 years so I could follow this passion project. I love you and owe you so much more than I can ever repay. So to everyone out there, this isn't goodbye. I'll be back with Feasting on Design, bringing you even more great designers and creators and taking a look into the creativity from brewers, distillers, chefs, restaurateurs, bartenders, and more. I hope you'll stick with me and that I'll see you all soon. It's no secret that I love Jack Prince. They're a longtime sponsor of the podcast and Creative South. Plus, they do great work. Whether they're making our pop-up displays and tablecloths or printing notebooks, Jack Prince is always there when we need them. This year, they are printing new Creative South t-shirts for me and the podcast stickers that have a coupon code on the back that gives you a great discount on all of their products just in time for Creative South. Speaking of stickers, Jack Prince will print any kind, shape, size, or stock, including full-color stickers with full-color liner prints, for you to use as product labels, promotions, bumper stickers, hang tags, business cards, and more. Right now, you can get 500 3x3-inch die-cut stickers, starting at $149. Plus, Jack Prince is giving Creative South Podcast listeners 15% off all orders over $25 when you use promo code CREATE15CS at checkout. Visit jackprince.com for your next order of stickers, prints, or whatever you need today. Ed, thanks for joining me this morning.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Sorry about the technical difficulties that we seem to be having, but as long as we can hear each other, we're doing great.
I think this is great. I can hear you, and I'm excited to talk to you.
All right. So let's dive into things real quick and tell me, where did you grow up?
Great question. I grew up in the southeast of the United States. I am from North Carolina. I was born in Durham, North Carolina, at Lincoln Memorial Hospital. Okay. And basically have grown up in the capital city, which is Raleigh, North Carolina.
Okay. So you've stayed in the triangle area your whole life, pretty much.
Exactly. I've been here. I'm a native and I have been here my entire life.
Awesome. Well, it's not a bad place to grow up.
No, it's not. It's not. It's been a really interesting place to grow up, and it's always been beautiful, and it's just home. So I love it.
Very cool. When you were growing up, what were you into? Were you a sports kid, arty kid, nerdy kid?
I was all three.
All three? Okay.
I was all three, and I'll tell you why. My dad, it was kind of legacy in our family. Football was huge in the Roberts household. So for a burgeoning artist like myself, I had to suit up every season. I played Little League. I played all kinds of sports, swimming. My parents had me in everything. And, you know, I remember even did junior striders, did cross country running.
Oh, fun.
For
I say that with all sarcasm.
Yeah, exactly. It was a lot of fun. So my parents always kind of had me involved. Creativity was not necessarily lauded in our household.
Sure.
I was kind of, my sister was the smart one and I was the creative one. So, but I played football from fourth grade all the way up to my freshman year in high school.
Okay.
And I went to a gifted and talented, what they call gifted and talented magnet school here in the Raleigh area.
And your sister was the smart one?
Well, she went to one too, but, okay. But you know, that, I guess that's how my mother kind of reconciled the two of us, or she described both of us.
Okay.
But I went to a school that focused a lot on the arts.
Okay.
And so it was a mixture of science, mathematics, and arts. And so I went there and really learned a lot about design, actually, from my art teachers. I had two of them because I had placed into what they call an art studio where we met, I think it was like two times a week. And we were in that studio for 2.5 hours.
Oh, wow.
And really focused on that, some high level science courses. And so I was doing a lot of art and science that 4 year period. So that's why I say I, you know, I'm a little bit of a jock, a lot of nerd, and a lot of creative. I was a bad jock though.
I know that feeling well. I was not a great athlete. I did swimming throughout high school, but,
Oh yeah. Yeah. I actually love swimming.
Yeah, me too.
I remember I learned how to swim at the YWCA, at their camp. Mm-hmm. And so I actually love swimming a lot. I haven't done that in a while.
Yeah. Unless you own a pool, it's kind of tough.
That's right.
So when you got to high school and you're taking, you know, you're in the magnet school and you're taking the advanced, you know, science and math as well as art classes and your teachers kind of expose you to design within math, does it click for you or was it just another class at the time?
Yeah, it's interesting. Science never really clicked for me. Oftentimes I would sit in that class and wonder why, how in the hell did I place into a science class? Because it was like one of the things I did not want to do. But there's a little interesting kind of moral to that thought that I'll bring up a little bit later. But when I was in the art class, I mean, we studied all kinds of things, but when it came to sort of a semester where we started to learn about design, actually the first time I ever heard the word logo was from an instructor that I had there. Her name was Carol Malik. Mm-hmm. And she did several weeks study on editorial design, publication design, just graphic design in general. And she taught us all about logos. And actually, it really did click for me based on some things that I was trying to figure out before I went to high school. I knew that I enjoyed drawing. Mm-hmm. I knew that I enjoyed art. And I knew that that was something that I wanted to do at a very early age. And I would say probably as far back as 8 years old. But I just didn't know what kind of career path. So
sure.
When I thought about Before that, those lessons, or before she taught those lessons, I thought of architecture. Mm-hmm. Again, this is that nerdy kid coming out, but I used to watch, I don't know if you watched a lot of public television, but I watched a lot of PBS.
Sure.
And there was,
it was one of the four channels that we got. So yeah, I watched a lot.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So you're old enough to remember that when it was just like three channels.
Oh yeah. I am old enough to remember pre-cable. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So there was a program on there called Nova.
Yeah. I love Nova.
Nova was great. And I remember watching as a real little kid, it was a plastic surgeon. And he was helping children with cleft palates. I think, you know, these were kids, I believe, in India. I remember that pretty distinctly. Mm-hmm. He would have these sort of mission trips where he would go over to India and help these kids out. And what was really, Jason, really kind of cool about that, and what stuck with me all these years, is that he didn't use photography. He actually would draw the kid's face as it was with the cleft palate. And then he would draw another photo, kind of almost like a before and after,
sure,
of what the child would look like after the surgery. And so for a kid looking at that, when I looked at that, it was amazing to kind of go through that story arc with him. And then see the child several months later after the surgery, and they look exactly like picture that he drew. And at that point I thought, man, I want to be a plastic surgeon. And Duke University is, you know, as I said, I was born in Durham, and so that's the home of Duke University, which I'm pretty sure if you like basketball, you're probably familiar with Duke.
Sure.
And so I started talking to a lot of folks, and they were like, you know, as I got older, they were like, you have to be super smart to go to Duke. So I kind of thought, you know, I was a little squeamish, so I don't think plastic surgery. And so I kind of landed on architecture until that class. Uh-huh. And then she taught us all about design, principles of design, and she talked specifically about publication design, and she talked about, when we were looking at a lot of like liquor ads in high school.
That was great for high school kids.
Cigarette ads. You know where I'm going with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that, I think she did that strategically to keep us interested.
Sure.
But as we were looking at a lot of those ads, she was kind of breaking them down, the structure of the ads, and talking about typographic hierarchy, the visuals, all of those things. And I think at the time, right before she took the job as a teacher, she was a practicing graphic designer. Huh. And then before that, she was a fashion model. Huh. So it was really interesting how she was tying up that all together. And so for me, the reason why I ticked boxes is because I was able to, like when I was looking at Nova, able to see the process.
Sure.
I was able to kind of see how she was sort of explaining the process of design. And then she started to talk to us about logos and brands. And back then, they didn't really, she didn't use, I don't remember her using the word brand like it's used today.
Yeah, that's more of a recent thing.
Yeah, but she talked specifically about logos, and I found that to be incredibly interesting. And so clearly something inside me just really sparked. Mm-hmm. And I knew at that point in high school that I wanted to be a graphic designer.
Gotcha. When you got out of high school and went to college, since you're in the pre-digital age, I'm going to just phrase it that way.
Oh, yeah.
Not to say that you didn't have computers, but like digital design, as far as websites and things like that, wasn't a thing.
Yep, non-existent.
What did you have a particular area of focus when you were in college that interested you more than others?
Well, I think when I went to school, I mean, I'm just going to go on and say it was the dark ages. You were being really nice. But it was a lot about craft, I think.
Sure.
and craft is really important today, but back when I was in school, way back when, it was all about the mechanicals, the wax machines, the stat cameras, rapidiograph pins, X-Acto blades, all of those things. And so, you know, cutting ruby lift, we were doing all of that stuff. So in a way, it was kind of an
art. Oh, yeah, I've done all that. Yeah.
Yep. And so you remember all that stuff.
Yep.
And so I remember, you know, working all nighters at the School of Design at North Carolina State University, and literally to get the work done. I mean, you had all your boards. I remember us taking the story of Brer Rabbit. Are you familiar with Brer Rabbit?
Yeah.
And as you can imagine, with that sort of poem or those poetic verses, there was a lot of opportunity to do something typographically with it. And so I remember sitting down and actually cutting out, after going to the CompuGraphic machine and typing out all of my typography, and going in and like literally cutting out each word to give them movement, waxing that stuff, putting it down.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, we did that entire story, and it took us a couple of weeks to do, but we all had to display not. I remember in college at that time, we would have our mechanical boards up.
Yeah.
So we would not really produce the actual things that we were designing. We wouldn't say go to Kinko's or it was a copy center here called Universal. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we would actually have them print our boards, and then we would do, I guess, mock-ups of things.
Sure.
But a lot of times, because it was more theoretically based, we would put those boards up because our instructors wanted to see our craft and thought that that was just as important as the design itself. Mm-hmm. And so I remember that very, very distinctly. So it was a very different age. But Jason, what was really cool was I remember when they started to get their first Macs. It kind of came in, or was in school around that time where it started to go in transition, where there was sort of the old way of doing things and then a new sort of digital age. I remember designers like April Griman during that time, during that new wave period, really pushing the limits of what computers could do, and how designers like that could leverage that tool. And so I remember many of us were sort of grappling with it at that time. You know, do I continue to do the wax machine and the stat cameras and the CompuGraphic machines, or do I embrace, you know, the Mac?
And all 700 floppy and all 700 floppy disks you needed to save
totally,
everything.
Oh, absolutely. Totally.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It was a fear. It was a total fear. Sure. I think for some people, you know, they really ran to it. But for me, I had sort of mixed feelings about it. And it made me wonder, OK, well, where is this going? But as you know, now it's interesting. Today, when I work with folks on my team, I remember, and you remember probably, times where we had to go to that sketch pad first.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now today, it's just common, I think, for a lot of folks to go directly to the computer.
Oh, yeah.
And I think in some ways that's a little unfortunate.
I would agree, and I can fully admit I have fallen into the bad habit of I don't always go directly to my sketch pad.
Right.
You know, I try to, but it really depends on what I'm having to design.
Yeah.
And you know, you were talking about earlier, you know, publication design when you were in high school and stuff like that. And with that stuff, I rarely go to my sketch pad ahead of time because I can get in there and I can sketch out thumbnail sketches all day long, but until you're actually physically positioning things, you know, it's just theory at that point. So,
absolutely.
But I will say I try to, if I'm doing logo design and things like that, try to go to my little piece of paper, and my sketch pad is usually a bunch of just loose leaf paper.
I mean, in a way it's really kind of key, I think.
Yeah.
I know that I have coached several designers who I've noticed, you know, I try not to step in the middle as a manager of creative people, not to step in the middle of their individual creative processes. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important to do, you know, to give everyone some breathing room. But at the same sure. time, what I've noticed is that when certain designers are struggling, maybe they're going to Pinterest and they're looking at sort of other people's work, or, you know, they're going to Logo Lounge, which is great, but, you know, they're going to all these resources to get their ideas. But I've noticed that a lot of times, you know, their own sketch pad is the last place that they go. And so what I've started to do, or have been doing for many years, is actually saying, hey, why don't you take some time to just kind of sit back and actually get your ideas out on paper. Mm-hmm. And what I have found is that when they do that, and then given all the resources that they have now at their disposal, I mean, at their fingertips, they come back with some fresher ideas, and they're able to work through some of those things because they've actually sketched it out.
Sure.
And so I do try to encourage my teams and the folks that I've worked with to kind of remember that sketch pad.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we get into that, because I do want to talk about that, let's kind of catch up on history. When you get out of college,
yeah.
Did you have an idea of what you wanted to do, like the realm of design you wanted to go into at that point?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. I knew immediately what I wanted to do. In fact, my last semester mm-hmm. at the School of Design, I chose to create my own studio.
Oh, okay.
And I did it in publication design, surprise, surprise, harkening back to high school. I knew that I wanted to work in a magazine. I was, you know, I was a fan of Rolling Stone.
Sure.
And I can tell you a little story about that. I was a fan of Interview magazine. I'm sure you mm-hmm. remember both of those.
Yeah.
So in the late 80s and awesome. I mean, they were everywhere.
Yeah.
And they were doing some incredible things with photography and incredible things with typography. And they were all over the place at the School of Design. I mean, and then, you know, the influx of like rock and roll and R&B and all of those celebrities. And then fashion also was interesting. And those magazines covered a lot of that. So for me, that was very interesting. And I thought, how cool would it be to, you know, be able to be a publications designer in New York? Mm-hmm. And so I did an independent study. I had a professor. His name is Kermit Bailey. Mm-hmm. At the School of Design, and I believe he's still there. And we worked through that entire semester, and I had I developed a magazine called Meridian.
Okay.
And it was surprising that I remember all this, Jason. This is amazing. but it was called Meridian.
Sure.
And I really did a lot of experimental typography. Mm-hmm. And really wanted to kind of break free from some of the stuff that I had been doing, in the standard studios. And, the nice thing is that right before I graduated, I actually got a job at a magazine.
Oh, awesome.
So, yeah. So that was really what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a publication designer.
Okay. So you get out of school, you've landed a role as a publication designer, and you're going through that. Was it as exciting and fulfilling as you had hoped it would be?
I wasn't prepared at all, man. I wasn't prepared at all. And you remember when I was talking about high school and how I was sitting in science class wondering how in the hell did I get in here?
Sure.
My first job was, wait for it, I was the art associate for American Scientist magazine.
yeah, I can.
There's a little bit of karma, I think, in there. But anyway, yeah, I mean, the reason why I say I felt like I wasn't prepared is because, you know, at a magazine, I mean, deadlines are like a freight train.
Sure.
And there's an immense amount of work. And, you know, when you're in college, or at least when I was in college, you had your deadline to get your work done to your professor, but you know, it's a whole different thing when your deadlines and meeting those deadlines are vital to a team's work. Right. And I know that when I was in college, that was really an eye opener. You know, I was working really by myself, but when I was out in the real world working at American Scientist, I was working with probably 12 other people that, you know, basically relied on me to get my work done so they could do their work.
Sure.
And so those deadlines were key. And then just production. I just didn't feel like I was really prepared for the amount of production that I had to do. Mm-hmm. And preparing those files to be sent out. So it was an eye opener.
Gotcha. As you progress and, you know, kind of get your footing and learn more, and how did the transition of having to work on teams and everybody be relying on each other and possibly being a linchpin and, you know, whether things go out or not, how did that wear on you?
Well, it was a lot of late nights. The good news is that I was experienced in working really late through mm-hmm. the school of design. You know, they called them all-nighters, and I think that's probably a, a commonality amongst a lot of folks that go to design school. So I was used to working really late. But I think for me, it was the subject matter. It was not like I was having to create just things just that I wanted to do. I didn't choose sure. the topic. Those things were already chosen.
Right.
I found myself as a designer sitting in editorial meetings where people talked about, you know, author submissions. I was working closely with editors, science editors. Mm-hmm. It was really going over my head. I mean, I could read an article. I could read probably three paragraphs. And then after that, I was done. I mean, I didn't know what they were talking about.
I was wondering.
I mean, nanotubes and, you know, all this craziness. But what was really interesting during that time, not only was I laying out the book, picking the cover art and things like that. But I had to, my main responsibility was creating all of the charts and graphs mm-hmm. And formalizing all of the statistical data that actually through visually helped to kind of explain the article or enhance at least the learning of those concepts that were being put out in the magazine. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I remember creating, I mean, I did thousands of what we know now to be information design or infographics. I did thousands of those things. And at that time in our industry, the design industry, that was not respected at all.
Sure.
And I know that because I would go on job interviews thinking, man, I need to get out of the science magazine and do some fun stuff. But anyway, I would show my portfolio and I would have creative directors say, OK, well, that's nice, but show me your design.
Yeah.
And so it's really interesting now today to see kind of where all of that has gone.
Data is key now.
Data is very, very key. And it's necessary, I think, mm-hmm. For people to really comprehend, you know, when you think about sort of the Challenger explosion. You know, I remember listening to a talk that Edward Tufte gave. He talked about just the graphs and the charts and the things that were developed, and they weren't developed clearly enough mm-hmm. So that people that were making decisions understood that there was issues with the O-ring.
Sure.
And so it really, you know, became clear to me that the work that I actually was doing at American Scientist later, because I worked there about 6 years, mm-hmm. actually it was really good work. And for me, it helped me by the time I left there to really understand what it was that I was creating for.
Sure.
And I was able to realize that, wow, I mean, the people that I'm doing work for are some of the world's preeminent scientist doing some really cutting edge work. And I get to work on those projects with them in concert with all those editors and other people. So it became a really well-oiled machine. And so for someone fresh out of college, it was a little bit of a stumbling block at the beginning. But I think what the job helped me do was learn how to research, I mean, really research, and gain some real understanding over the information that I was designing. And I will say that that experience has really guided how I actually work today and on every job that I've had. I don't approach it just as, you know, what can I do visually? I just want it to be beautiful. You know, this notion, I remember a lot of designers would say, I just want it to be pretty. Or can I, you know, I've had even designers tell me, can I just make it, I just want to make it beautiful. Well, yes, you can do that. But also it's important for you to design with intention. Mm-hmm. And that intention comes from education and understanding what it is that you're designing for. What is that thing? I remember talking to a designer one time who was doing a brochure. And he was showing me some concepts and they really weren't hitting the mark. And I just simply asked him, I said, well, tell me about this particular the subject matter that you're designing for. Tell me about this thing that they're talking about in this brochure. And they couldn't tell me. Mm-hmm. And I said to them, I said, well, let's start there. How about you take 2 to 3 hours, because they had the time, it was built into the schedule. But take 2 to 3 hours. And what I want you to do is I want you to learn as much as you can about this thing that you're designing for. And then let's come back and meet. And we came back and we met, and this person still had some questions. And so there was actually a number on the brochure. I said, well, have you called the contact person here on this brochure? Oh, no, I haven't done that. I said, well, let's call them. And so they looked at me like I had lobsters coming out of my ears. Let's call them. I said, you have these questions. I don't know about it, but let's confirm what you've learned. And so it was really interesting to see the lights come on, because the person answered the phone. This designer was able to ask questions. This person was glad to, you know, give the answers, was probably glad that somebody was even interested in the topic.
Sure.
But what I have found is after that, I think the next day when I came back, the design had just taken off. It was like planting seeds, and this designer watered them and fertilized them. And the next day, the design really sang. And so for me, it's really important to understand today not only the strategy that's fueling the work and what the marketers are trying to do, but actually understanding and reading the content and asking questions, because all of those things coupled together are going to help me, I believe, design an incredible piece, because I will be designing from intention and knowledge.
Sure. So, you know, you're honing these skills, and obviously, you know, that understanding of it came with time and understanding the client and all that.
Yeah.
When you finally make the switch out of the publication design and you're moving into more of an in-house role, does it dawn on you that process immediately, or is that a kind of trial and error thing?
You mean the research and doing all of that?
Yeah. Because it's a very different environment.
Yeah. I think working with, I think what was really pivotal for me is working with, the editors at the magazine. Mm-hmm. All of these folks had PhDs from Brown, literally Brown, Stanford, Harvard, Columbia.
Sure.
They were all scientists with PhDs. And in fact, you know, they never wore that on their sleeves. It was several years before I even knew any of them had PhDs. Mm-hmm. And so in the Triangle area here, in North Carolina, that's a really big thing.
Yeah.
You know, because we have Duke, and, you know, so that's really important. And so I was amazed that I was collaborating with folks who, had such deep knowledge in the things that they were editing and writing. And I would just watch them actually go through the process. In some instances, when it was some breakthrough science that was coming out, they were learning. And so for me, it was like I was sitting in on those calls and watching them take notes and dig really deeply and then translating all of that into their work. And so it was sort of like a masterclass for me as a designer, although they weren't designers. I kind of recognized that they had a creative process.
Sure.
Because they were also writers. And they and everything that they did, it was all about accuracy and being able to kind of go back and verify what it is that they were doing and what it is that they were getting ready to put out there. And so I wanted to bring that to my work. And so for me, it was, like I said, it was a masterclass that basically those tenets that I learned, I took everywhere. So right after I left American Sinus, I went to an agency, and even in working with some of those clients, it was a business-to-business agency, and a lot of our clients were sort of more technology-based.
Sure.
I found myself in the meetings asking them, so what is flip chip wafer processing? Can you explain that to me? You know, I mean, I'm just a designer, and these engineers were looking at me like, who is this guy? And then I would go back, and the next time we would have a meeting, I might show some concepts, but I would also talk to them about what I learned about the actual product itself that they were producing that I was actually developing the advertising
for. Sure.
And so for me, I found that the research was really important. And from a client perspective, I could remember clients asking just for me. Mm-hmm. And I can attribute that to the fact that I showed interest in what it was that they were doing.
Gotcha.
And I think that that's incredibly important for a designer. I mean, we all talk about, you know, a lot of folks talk about wanting to continually educate themselves. Mm-hmm. Our opportunity with our clients to learn some different things.
Sure.
And see how we could leverage, you know, what our talents are to help promote those things that our clients are trying to promote.
Sure. How are you getting creative buy-in from the clients at that point? And I ask this because, so I work for an engineering firm, like industrial engineering.
Okay. So you
and
did.
I do. And I understand that, you know, I think part of this is my dad's a mechanical engineer.
Okay. My uncle was one.
Okay. So I can see that there is a creative process in engineering, but it's coupled
yes.
with the science and the math and all that.
Yes.
So the engineers may not understand that there is a creative process in what they do. And
right.
so getting buy-in from them on something that is creative, especially since they are a very linear thinking bunch, can be
yeah.
a challenge. How do you tackle that sort of thing?
So for me, again, it goes right back to on the front end, learning as much as I can about their business, about what they care about. And in doing so, thinking about how I can kind of create work that will resonate with them. And also showcase the fact that I listened. I found that I was able to work with a lot of those highly technical folks well, because they understood that when I came to the meeting, I would give them an objective or talk about the objectives of what it was that we were trying to design. And I would weave in some of those lessons that I learned from them. And always did it in such a way that they knew that it wasn't just creativity that I was talking about, but I was actually talking about that thing that they are most passionate about as well. And so I was able to kind of bring them into the fold. And we would have a conversation about that and I would listen. But then I would sort of paint a picture for them or tell a story basically of how we could promote that. What I found with a lot of highly technical people is that they're so focused on that thing that they've been researching or working on for so many years, that marketing for them is really not, they don't
it's not
view
a priority.
It as, it's not a priority. Absolutely. And what I'm able to do is weave in, or at least tell them why it is a priority. Mm-hmm. Because you can do all of that work for so many years, but if no one knows that you're doing it, you know, is it like have you ever done it?
Yeah.
I'm able to at least bring them to the table when I can actually speak their language. Now I can't say that I go that deep to where I can do their work.
Sure.
But I try to learn as much of it so that when we are at the table with that creative, that they know that I fully understand what it is that they have been working on, what it is and how that thing works. Mm-hmm. And what the outcome will be and what the impact could be to the world. And so what I try to do is I try to use that knowledge and then I try to almost kind of report back to them. Mm-hmm. And then weave in the creative from there and let them know this is how, you know, we can handle the advertising of this particular thing, whatever that thing would be.
Sure. When you do all of those steps and you hit roadblocks internally, mm-hmm. How do you tackle those?
Communication is really, really key. It's interesting. I read somewhere where 70% of communication is not understood or heard.
Sure.
And only a small percentage of the words that you say really it's so much more than that. I mean, it's your body language. It's, you know, everything. So for me, it's when I encounter roadblocks, I have to think to myself, am I communicating well enough? Mm-hmm. And what I try to do from the onset of any project is I try to get all the players together and particularly the client and get the client to talk about their objectives and their goals and what it is that they have been doing. And just try to get people on the same page so that we can avoid as many roadblocks as possible. They do come up, but for me, this package is clearly going to be in large part due to a lack of communication.
Sure.
And so, you know, that's when I try to use those communication skills that I have and go back and say, like, I had an issue last night. And I remember, emailing the client this morning and saying, hey, first of all, thank you so much for the opportunity to work on this project. My team and I are really excited about it. What I'd like to do, if you're okay with this, I'd like for us at the end of this project to do a project retrospective where we look at the roses, the buds, and the thorns. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of a tenet of design thinking. And, you know, from that, what I want to do is I want to learn how we can actually, you know, provide you higher quality and be more efficient. And I got an email back saying, yes, let's absolutely do that. Mm-hmm. So again, it's all about that communication because we had encountered, and this is just literally like yesterday,
sure.
some challenges. But it's really important, I think, to get everybody in the room, and talk about those challenges so that we can at least get them out on paper or at least verbalize them so that we know, okay, well, next year when we do a project similar to this, these are the kind of hurdles that we want to make sure that we avoid. So I hope that answers your question, but I do think communication is really key and constantly communicating.
Sure. I'm curious about that because, you know, I've worked at places where I definitely agree with you. Communication is key, but the other side of the coin is not always as open to communicating openly about things. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. And, you know, without naming clients, I had a client that, you know, very similar situation. We met a bunch of challenges. Yeah. And, you know, I reached out and I was like, let's talk about, you know, the good, the bad, the ugly of what went mm-hmm. right, what went wrong, where mm-hmm. we could do a little improvement, where yeah. we see things. And they didn't want to talk about it. All they wanted to talk about was the negative of these are all the problems that we had. And it's like, well, that's great. We do need to address those, but we've got to figure out where we've done things right so we know what goals to benchmark for and be able to find ways to improve on that. And if we're only talking about one aspect of things, you know, we can't have a full conversation. We can't do the problem solving.
Yeah. Yeah. And you articulated that to them.
Yes. As best I could.
Yeah. No, I mean, your approach, I mean, you know, sort of the spirit of your approach, actually, I think is spot on. But, you know, there are those clients that, you know, as designers, we have to just recognize is that, you know, you kind of have to understand sort of what their mission is behind that. Mm-hmm. If this client really just wanted to talk about the negatives, mm-hmm. but wasn't interested in really going down a path with you on how you could solve that so you could avoid it in the future. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes for me, it's sort of like I'm wondering, okay, well, what's the motive there? You know, what's really driving that? And I wanted to ask, did you ask that? Was that a face-to-face conversation or was that over the phone?
It was over the phone.
Yeah. See, sometimes I tell you, it's interesting. Jason, my approach sometimes when I've encountered that, because I have,
sure,
is I sometimes go directly to their offices. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's something to be said for actually being right there in front of someone and saying, "Hey, do you have a few minutes just to chat?"
Sure.
And I always open with like an icebreaker. So, how was the weekend, or whatever that thing was,
right?
Or thing, I find things that maybe they're interested in. I mean, I know that may sound a little manipulative, but you know, I call it strategic. Mm-hmm. But it's just a way to kind of get us to level us out and both get us on the page and get them to want to listen. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes what I have done is I've just invited people to lunch. Mm-hmm. And maybe I don't go with, I mean, I've got an objective in my mind. Like, you know, man, we go through these challenges. I don't want to do that again.
Sure.
But, you know, I'm thinking, okay, how can I get this person to at least meet me at the well? You know, I can't make them drink, but how can I at least guide them on the path and meet me at the well? And sometimes I've done a lot of breaking bread with clients and also my teams and outside folks. And I've just sort of had a lunch. You know, we all have to eat. I have a lunch, we just shoot in the breeze, and then just peppering in the conversation about, you know, what did you think about, you know, XYZ project? At that point, everybody's kind of feeling good. And then I think too that they don't feel in environments like a lunch setting, mm-hmm. Or even, you know, sometimes face to face, you have to be careful about the face to face. But
sure.
If it's in a lunch setting, people's guards are let down. And I think they're a little bit more relaxed. And the conversation doesn't immediately start with, here are the challenges that we face. I want to sort of work with you now to figure out how we can kind of avoid it. It's more like, hey, man, how you doing? And how are the kids? And, man, you know, this is an awesome restaurant. And then you, as through the course of just the natural conversation, you can bring those things up.
You kind of work into it naturally,
Yeah. And I have found through that, that I've been able to kind of get through that honey. I've been able to get more flies to come to me. You know what I'm saying? So,
sure.
You know, it sometimes I think we have to kind of change our approach to get to the place that we want to get to.
Gotcha. With that, you know, there also comes. Well, actually, I don't know if the two are related, but in my mind, they kind of are. It's a lot of in-house people are teams of one or teams of one and two and
small.
Yeah. I mean, I personally work for, like I said, I work for an engineering firm. We've got 13 offices and 2,300 people. And I'm the lone in-house creative.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Do you have battle scars?
So much therapy. And I mean, my biggest issue is getting them to buy into why creative is important and how creative can help improve and promote things. And not just in the marketing, but sometimes Well, I mean, I guess it's marketing, but it's not. Mm-hmm. They view it. They view marketing a lot of times in two very separate camps.
Yeah.
There is what I do, where it's advertising focused and promotional pieces and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then there's the other, which they view as the much more important, and they're willing to put resources behind it of, you know, proposals, presentations, pitch decks, mm-hmm. things like that.
Yeah.
So they get that aspect.
But data.
Yeah, and there's data in that. And what I'm trying to do is to bridge that gap to say, yes, that is important. This is important too, but you've got to be able to combine the two to make a holistic effort.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, you know, there's, you know, the cart can be leading the horse too many times.
You're absolutely right. And I think that, you know, what you've just pointed out is a challenge that is prevalent throughout the world, really. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to me and the folks that I've talked to over the years that there are some major companies doing some major stuff in this world, and they have really small creative teams, in-house mm-hmm. teams. And these in-house teams are incredibly overworked.
Amen.
They have been positioned as order takers and not business partners. Mm-hmm. Some of these organizations view them almost as liabilities.
Sure.
And so I think what's most important, and it depends on the company, but I can only go off of my experience. But what I have found is when I'm able to relate what I am doing for that organization to the business strategies of the organization, mm-hmm. And when I'm in meetings or when I have an opportunity, if I'm walking down the hall and I'm going to the kitchen and we're searching breeze and I'm sort of, and then I share what I'm doing and how that, you know, could help them. Mm-hmm. I'm always thinking about how the work that I do can be relatable to them. And the common thing that I think that all leaders and organizations understand is the sort of strategic priorities of that organization. And so as a creative, if you're a team of 1, 2, 3, or 35, if you're able to kind of align how you conduct your business and also align the work you create with the objectives of that organization, and you can speak that language, therein lies some credibility, and it will grow, I think, sure, throughout the organization. So what I'm getting at is, you know, it has always been really important. I worked for an energy company for about 9 years. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of a quasi government agency energy company. You know, we worked with a lot of municipalities, cities and towns that owned and operated their own electric systems. Mm-hmm. And so when I came in there, it was sort of like, oh, golly, how in the world am I going to, you know, create work that's beautiful that I want to do for an organization like this.
Sure.
And then I quickly realized that, you know, in that organization, you know, we were kind of viewed as, we were a small team. I managed a writer and a designer. Mm-hmm. And coming in, we were really viewed as kind of order takers. You know, we need this PowerPoint tomorrow. And on top of that, you know, I've got this other thing. We need that by 4 o'clock today. You know, and it just was like this onslaught. But it took time. But I remember sitting in a lot of those monthly management business review meetings mm-hmm. and taking notes and doing a lot of listening and actually speaking up and trying to relate to them. Hey, this thing that we're talking about right now, here's what my team is doing to help with that. And I remember doing one time a talk. I had to do a presentation about my department to all the management staff that include the CEO. And one of the things that I said to them is and I broke down what our department was called strategic communications. We didn't have one of the fancy, you know, names that that's sort of trending now for in-house teams. We were just strategic communications.
Yeah. You were a department, not necessarily an in-house agency, as a lot of people are tending to do now. Right.
Exactly. Exactly. But I remember distinctly some lights coming on when I broke down what strategic and communications means, because when I was breaking that down, I was trying to get them to see that we were business partners for them. Mm. And it was one thing that I said is I said, we don't put lipstick on a pig. And the pig essentially was their work.
Sure.
And I was letting them know that we understand that the work that they do is important. And so we're not doing that. But what we are doing, and I remember distinctly, I had a slide. I said, what we are doing is we are giving wings to your ideas. And we're nourishing that, and we're helping those ideas take flight. And when I said that, it was sort of like I could see some lights coming on. They kind of understood then that we really were sort of aligned with them and what they were trying to do. And I even talked a little bit about relating a lot of what we were doing to the strategic priorities that we had, you know, service excellence, corporate integrity, you know, all of those things that were, you know, communicating the value of public power, wholesale supply costs, all of the things that were important to that organization. I wove that into that talk, and I really fully understood so that when they asked me questions, I could not only talk about the creative side of it, but I also had a real firm understanding of the business side. And that again goes back to what I talked about a little bit earlier about that research.
Sure.
So I would say that for those teams of 1 to 35, if you really want to do your best work, I think your best work begins with researching the content and future
trying. One of the things that I've noticed that I run into is, like, I can research the content and I have a basic grasp of what we do, slightly more than basic grasp, enough that I can communicate it and not sound like a blathering
idiot.
That's
awesome.
But our teams, especially in the upper management of things, they don't always look at things as the marketing department being a strategic partner. But they also don't look at the other departments, whether it be, you know, electrical engineering or, you know, process. They don't look at those as strategic partners. They look at those as they're all worker bees.
Yeah.
We'll handle the strategy, but you're supposed to know what that is, but we're not going to communicate that to you.
Ooh, that sounds like a big old silo.
It is. And when you work for, and I've worked for a couple companies that are very much like that, where everything is so siloed off, but they expect you to understand what their motivation is.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, how do you help break down those walls and help facilitate an open understanding of, you know, I don't need to necessarily know all of the nuts and bolts, and I don't need to know every strategic decision you're going to make, whether it be, you know, hey, we're going to open a new office and it's going to be, you know, positioned in this place because, you know, that's at the crossroads of these different industries and, you know, they meet. That's not necessarily, there is a time and a place where that is very important. But for the day-to-day operations of how an internal design team and internal agency works within the marketing, you don't necessarily need to know that on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. But on the overall basis, you do need to know what everybody's doing and how to properly position that and properly communicate that to not only the internal marketing efforts, but to the external marketing efforts.
Yes, I agree with you wholeheartedly. And, you know, just to kind of go back to the silo comment, you know, I firmly believe, and I'm sure you do too, that for any organization, whether they realize it or not, and that, you know, it comes from the top really, but if the top doesn't realize that silos impede innovation, then they're not going to be in business long. And I think creative teams should also think that, and it doesn't necessarily have to be the individual contributor on that team, but surely whether you're a team of one or several other folks, as the leader of that team, you've got to understand. I mean, my feeling is that, you know, that's part of my job is to really understand that business and know what those moves are that they're going to make.
Sure. That's my understanding too.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, so maybe my graphic designer may not, maybe the photographer may not, maybe the writer may not, you know, maybe the front end web developer may not, but I've got to know. Mm-hmm. And then I've got to be able to boil that information down to them individually so that they can do their not only their best work, but that work that's well informed so that when it goes back out, people are like, yeah, OK, we don't need to make too many changes to this. You guys seem to have a real good grasp of what it is that we're trying to do. I think a lot of times with a lot of clients, they just want to be heard, mm-hmm. you know, and I think in-house teams in particular can be that catalyst for helping to break down some of those silos by being able to reach out. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you've got to be able to kind of, you know, ring your own bell, really. You know what
sure.
I mean? You've got to be out there doing it because no one else is going to do it.
Right.
And I think, you know, a lot of times when you work in sort of highly technical organizations like you do and like I have, you've got to do it. Because those folks are actually, you better believe those folks that are working in those silos, they want to surpass the expectations. They want those bonuses. They want sure. their divisions to do really well. But we as in-house leaders have also got to do the same for our teams.
Right.
You know, and sometimes I think we sort of couch in this, oh, woe is me.
Mm-hmm. I'm guilty of having done that.
Oh, I have too. And but I think sometimes push yourself. Like for me, I have always felt kind of like the departments that I've been a part of or that I've led, we're sort of like, I view it as like an oasis.
Sure.
We are like so different from anyone else, you know, in that organization. But I also, particularly when I've led those teams, small or larger, I have felt like it was my responsibility to constantly be out there selling the value mm-hmm. Of that partnership. And so when you're doing that, and I mean, man, I'm telling you, it is a ton of work because not only was I doing that, but I also was a working manager.
Sure.
I just didn't manage. I mean, I've never had the luxury of just kind of like, you know, just sitting back and having the time to like, you know, develop master plans.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's been like, well, holy crap, you know, let me think about this or maybe take some notes. Let me make sure I've got my notepad here and just take these notes and then I can kind of develop some emails later. But I got to go to this meeting because we've got to do this, you know, major event.
Sure. And plus, I've got to knock out this design stuff. Because my team has too much. Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. I know that feeling well.
And here's the thing. A lot of us are living that way.
Sure.
So, you know, I really, you know, anyone listening to this podcast, I'd love to tell them that if you are looking to, if you're working in house and you want to make that leap into sort of more of a leadership role, mm-hmm. I just want to be really honest that it is your life, your professional life definitely changes mm-hmm. because not only are you responsible for the careers of everybody under you, in many ways, if you're doing it right, you're also sort of shouldering a part of the responsibilities of making sure that organization is successful if you're mm-hmm. doing it right. Mm-hmm. And then promotion and actually doing the work in such a way that it's innovative and showing other departments that maybe aren't as easy to work with. I'm showing them a new way to work and showing them through your example the possibilities.
Sure.
So,
yeah, I think for me, I think that's my biggest challenge where I am very much a person who wants to, I don't want to say I'm a company man, but because that has mm-hmm. negative conversations, but
right.
my goal is to make sure that the company has its best face forward.
Yeah.
And a lot of times to my own detriment that me promoting the company and putting all of that on the forefront takes away from me being able to promote myself and my team internally to show that that's mm-hmm. what we're doing.
Yeah.
And
when, it's definitely a balance.
Yeah. And when you run into, like, in these highly technical companies, when you run into that, there's a lot of very linear thinking, and they're not always, they're on a straight and narrow path of this is what we want to do. And they're not looking at the things that are on the fringes that are helping them get there. So being able to be a partner makes that easier. So,
yes.
And that's where the challenge runs in.
Yeah. Yeah. And I agree with you, but I'd like to say that, you know, to be honest with you, I think there's nothing wrong, and maybe people will hate this, but I don't think there's anything wrong with, and I think you would agree based on what you just said, that company man, I think is actually an advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Any in-house team, think about Apple.
Yeah.
They've got about 1,000 or more people on their in-house team there.
Sure.
They probably all have to sign some sort of, you know, agreement. They never talk about what they're working on.
NDA. That's a full novel.
They probably have to like offer up one of their children.
Yeah.
Know, or something like that.
Some sort of blood sacrifice. Yeah.
You can't be more of a company man or woman than an Apple.
Right.
And look how innovative they are. But Apple is based on, you know, founded on innovation, just as Facebook, Google, all these. And wrong with being entrenched. I think it's incredibly important to be entrenched. And also, here's the other thing that I'd like to say, too, because I've played both roles. I mean, I know you want to definitely be a partner, because if you're not a partner, you're going to be an order taker, and then you run the risk of not being there at all.
Sure.
Because it's so easy, I think, although the trend now, I think, is clients wanting to bring, you know, build their in-house teams. But for many years, it was like, well, you know, the in-house team is not very creative. We're just going to take it out. Mm-hmm. So a lot of in-house folks were kind of concerned about that.
Oh, believe me, I've worked at plenty of those places. And
Me too. And, you know, you try to balance, as we talked about a little bit earlier about the balance, you try to balance all of the business side of what you have to do, particularly if you're an in-house manager.
Sure.
But you're also grappling with do we have the funds to be as creative as say, an outside agency?
Mm-hmm.
But I think, too, the other thing is you want to be a partner. But in those meetings, sometimes you got to be that dartboard, too.
Right.
You've got to be that gut check. And there's nothing wrong with being the one person in the room, the sea of everybody that's on the same page, and saying, hey, but there is another way that we can do this, and being that voice. And so I have actually played that role. I mean, I came home to my wife sometimes and I'd say, well, I've had so many darts thrown at me today. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, my heart was always in the right place. It was always focused on the business. It was always focused on the business and also new ways of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But those new ways of thinking were based and rooted in the foundation that everyone had bought into at that organization.
Gotcha.
It's totally tough.
Yeah. How do you know when is the right time to be the dartboard and when is the right time to be the dart?
Oh, man, that's a really good question. You know, that takes a lot of years. You know, and how long have you been at your company?
I've been at my company almost 7 years now.
Yeah, that's a long time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the reason why I ask that question and anyone else that may be listening to this, you know, you just have to make sure that you really understand the people in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to modulate how you communicate to them, getting your point out, but getting it out so that it can be heard.
Sure.
And then being prepared is kind of like preparation opportunity, you know?
Yeah.
Being prepared that when they turn to you and start throwing those darts, that you can kind of answer back, you know, or when they sort of say, well, this won't work because of X. You've got to be prepared to kind of explain. So never throw yourself out there, you know, into the fray if you're not prepared to come back with some really solid points.
Sure.
And really solid answers to maybe questions that may come up to folks that you know, just based off of your prior experiences with them, you know that this person, everybody has a John that, is going to wear a black hat in, uh-huh. in every single meeting. Mm-hmm. And so you've got to learn how to communicate with John so at least he can take that black hat off for a moment.
Ironically, understand. The that guy at our company is literally named John.
there's one in every company, Jason.
Oh yeah. Yeah. He's a very nice guy, but he is he's definitely he's a vacuum of hope.
well, you know what we say in the South.
I'm in the South. South. Yeah.
Bless his heart.
Yeah, very much so.
But you got to be firm. You know, really have to be firm.
Sure. Well, you know, we're kind of getting close to our time here, but I want to touch on a couple things real quick just to. You know, I think we've talked about a lot of good stuff regarding how to be a good in-house designer, but I want to talk about your kind of career transition that you've had recently.
Yeah.
Where, and correct me if I'm wrong in my understanding of this, you've gone from being the strictly in-house guy to being more of a consultant to in-house teams on how to build that stuff. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I'm still an in-house manager. I work for a global organization. But I have, through my work with HOW, FW Media and the creative group, it's given me some opportunities where I have met with, some other in-house managers who, have gone through some of the same things that I've gone through that I'm still going through. Mm-hmm. And so I do some consulting with them. And right now, specifically, I'm working with a really brilliant creative director who works for a national emerging beauty brand. Mm-hmm. And they're doing some really cool stuff. And so we talk a lot about developing core values, developing a purpose for, you know, her in-house team, and aligning all of that. I think we've talked a little bit about that, but aligning all of that with the mission and vision of the organizations that you work for. Mm-hmm. So yes. And so the team that I'm working with now, I'm actually having to hire about 5 people. I'll probably be taking on a few more people. You know, in fact, when I was hired, you know, the VP mentioned to me that, you know, we're hiring you to bring some innovation, to help us bring some innovation into our organization.
Gotcha.
And so that's what I'm doing right now.
Okay. Looking towards the future of what you've got coming up and that you're allowed to talk about, I have to preface that with everybody because we have so many things that either we've signed an NDA on or it's just not ready to be talked about. What exciting do you have coming down the pike?
Well, I have been writing a book.
Really?
Yes, I have. I did a pitch to Simon & Schuster probably a year ago. I got some feedback, but they rejected the first one. But what I'm doing is I'm sitting down and I'm really trying to kind of put all of my thoughts together about, you know, really sort of advocating as an in-house manager, advocating for your team. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking even broader because a lot of the things that I have done, you know, a lot of managers in general can do with their teams and within their organizations. It doesn't necessarily mean just creatives, mm-hmm. but I'm sort of taking some of the tenets of just general design thinking and the things in the processes that we do. And I have been working on a book, so I'm going to pitch it. But even if it doesn't get picked up, I'm going to look into self-publishing. So that's one of the things that I'm doing.
Very cool.
Yeah. And then I just recently did a talk in Philadelphia, AIGA National in concert with AIGA Philly and AIGA DC had a new conference series called the AIGA Lead Con. And I did about 3 workshops there.
Okay.
You know, promote it to creative director. Now what is basically what I talked about. And so a lot of the ideas that I went over in the workshop with the attendees are some of the basis for the book that I'm developing.
Very cool. Well, real quickly, where can people find you online?
Yeah. So on Twitter, I am at Inhouse Obs, and on Instagram, it's eRoberts3.
Very cool. And we'll link to all that in the show notes, as well as to your Behance page.
Perfect.
Ed, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me this morning. Oh, I really absolutely appreciate it.
I hope people enjoy it.
I think they will. I got a lot out of it, so I'm hoping other people do. So
awesome. Thank you.
Go out and hug some necks.
All right. Appreciate it. Thanks.
You can find out more about Ed on Twitter at InhouseObs, and be sure to check out the links in the show notes for more ways to keep up with him. You can keep up with the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Feast on Design. And be sure to follow Creative South on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Creative South GA or over at CreativeSouth.com. And I'm at Jay Frostholm on Dribbble, Twitter, and Instagram. Jack Prince is giving Creative South podcast listeners 15% off all orders over $25 when you use promo code CREATE15CS at checkout. Visit jackprince.com for your next order of stickers, prints, or whatever you need today.
For a limited time, new Skillshare customers can get their first 3 months for just 99 cents to get unlimited access to thousands of classes when you sign up at Skillshare.com using promo code Creative South. What are you waiting for? Start learning today. And remember, if you like the show, help support us over at patreon.com/creativesouth. And if you like the Creative South podcast, head over to iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. Rate us and leave a review. This helps more people find the podcast and allows us to keep getting awesome guests. Now go out and hug some necks.